Thanks, Tony. This is the one time in my life I wish I could close the laptop and just like go over and play Rachmaninoff or something.
Why don't you do that?
Because I can't play the piano, unfortunately. But it.
Well, then fly.
It'd be really dramatic if I could. That'd be great. I can imagine you could put up a different instrument each week and see if you get lucky.
That's a good idea.
So, as Tony described, I've actually been interested in insect biology throughout my life. In fact, I also read the same book, To Know a Fly, by Vincent Detier.
Is that a good book? I mean,
oh yeah, it's a very humorous book.
Yeah, I read the right thing, right?
Yeah, no.
I didn't do the experiment. Is it true you can turn a fly into a spherical ball, which Frank Wilczek claims that you can do?
I don't remember that particular experiment, but that might have been in the second edition or something. That was a book by Vincent Detier that's a spectacular book. He's kind of the Thurber of insect biology. There's a lot of wonderful cartoons in To Know a Fly. Just a couple of things about insects. They are an extraordinarily successful group of organisms. Zoologists used to say that they were the most species-rich group of organisms on the planet. That's probably an overstatement, because we don't know that much about the diversity of small things such as bacteria and nematodes, because the taxonomy is a lot more difficult, species identification. But certainly of macroscopic organisms that you can see, you can pick up with your fingers and eat and pull the wings off, for example, this is really the most successful radiation in the history of life. There's somewhere between 6 and 60 million species of insects, depending upon who's counting, and they've dominated a terrestrial ecosystem since their emergence in the Devonian period. And it's pretty easy, in fact quite pleasant, to imagine what the world would be like without, say, humans. It's almost impossible, I think, to imagine what the world would be like without insects, because they play such an integral part in ecology. Given the importance, it's not surprising that zoologists often describe why insects, why are they so successful? Why did they from their emergence, they just sort of dominate terrestrial ecosystems? And there's no simple, single answer, but certainly one of the main important forces is the evolution of flight. They were the first animals to evolve active flight, which happened three times subsequently. But I think in many ways they remain sort of the most aerodynamically sophisticated devices on the planet, and I include human-built devices in that categorization. So it's been somewhat of an embarrassment, I think, that physiologists and zoologists and physicists and engineers have had such a difficult time explaining how insects fly. Now, rather than talking specifically about the aerodynamics of insect flight, I'm actually going to give a little bit more of a broad overview that really relates more to my specific interest, which is to study really the behavior of insects and how nervous systems control behavior. And in neuroethology, the study of the neural control of behavior, people tend to study two different kinds of organisms, either simple organisms that are easy to study, such as a Nobel Prize was won several years ago for studying a sea slug. And it's not that a sea slug is a particularly clever animal, but it has really big neurons that allow people to put a lot of electrodes in them, for example. But another approach in studying how nervous systems control behavior is to study organisms that do something particularly well, that excel at a particular type of behavior. So, for example, we know more about auditory processing because of studies of barn owls and bats. And it's not that barn owls and bats are particularly easy to study. In fact, they're very difficult to study, but they have remarkable capacity of auditory processing. And so structure-function relationships are clearer in those organisms than they are in a lot of other organisms. And I think that the work that my lab does on flies fits within this category, because although flies are rather sort of mundane. They don't look like, you know, they exhibit spectacular behaviors. This is one of the things they can do. This has been an inspiration to me. This is a picture that was shot with high-speed cameras by Hermann Wagner at the Max Planck Institute for Biological Cybernetics 16 years ago. And it shows about a half-life in, half second in the life of a male and female housefly. And as people like Bill Rice can tell you, you know, so much of biology really comes down to sex. And this is the sort of aerial phase of sex for a housefly. So the male and female indicated by black and white lollipops. And what's happened in the sequence is that the female has flown into the territory that the male patrols. The male picks up the female on his retina and attempts to track her flight trajectory as accurately as he can. Some species of fly, the male actually grasps the females and starts copulation immediately. In other species, it's a little bit more gentle. They land, more courtship takes place. But the initial goal here is for, you know, if you will, the male to impress the female with his aerodynamic skill. Now, at this point in the trajectory, you can see after the male's done a very good job from the time he sees the female. The female does this evasive maneuver. For a while, the male is actually flying backwards. He spins out of control. He's sliding sideways while the female does that large evasive blip. But he does a hairpin turn, sees the female again, and the chase continues. And the chase continues. It's just that it ran out of the focal, you know, length of the lenses. Now, Hermann and others before him, Tom Collett and Mike Land, did such experiments. We were able to do an analysis of the basically the changes in the angular and translational velocity of the lead fly and the chase fly, and we're able to show that from the time that the lead fly changes its position on the chasing fly's retina, the chasing fly initiates a compensatory reaction within 30 milliseconds. There's extremely rapid processing time that's going through somewhere between 5 and 6 synapses, all the sluggish delay of phototransduction, the generation of mechanical forces in the muscles, the production of aerodynamic forces. These animals are specialized to process sensory information and to turn that sensory information into a motor code. And it's that feature of the biology that I find fascinating and has also fascinated a lot of other neurobiologists. So we know a lot about the basic capacity of the nervous system in these organisms, but that isn't to say we know a lot about flight. And the philosophy that we've taken in my laboratory, I should step back and say, when I was a graduate student, the macho thing to do if you're interested in behavior was to rip out the brain out of an organism, throw the animal in the trash can, and stick a lot of electrodes in the brain. And I'm really not exaggerating that much. The idea was to basically put the brain in a dish, and that's how we all talked about it. But however, I think anybody here can see that there's a problem. It's hard to interpret what that sort of set of algorithms the nervous system is generating mean unless you understand the hardware that it was designed to control. And so in the research in the lab and other people have come to the same conclusion, it's very important to understand, you really have to understand the mechanics and the dynamics and the complex properties of the musculoskeletal system to even be able to interpret what motor commands issuing from the nervous system mean. And carrying on this theme, it's not easy to understand what, say, forces generated in muscles or kinematic motions of appendages mean unless we understand their interaction with the external environment, when the case of a flying animal means some rather complicated aerodynamic interactions. And finally, as the animal, say, flapping its wings or moving its legs or whatever, it's changing its orientation through space, bringing it into different sensory fields. And it's getting on a wing-beat by wing-beat basis new sensory information, which is modifying what the motor system is doing. And what we call behavior, what generates the complexity shown in the last slide, is really sort of emergent property of this of a complicated set of feedback interactions. And the strategy that we've tried to use in my laboratory is, rather than isolating our research on one particular component of this complex feedback, which is an important thing to do, because we can't sacrifice depth for for breadth, but certain kinds of and I think an important perspective emerges when one tries to understand this and study this as an interactive whole. So basically, what I'm going to do in the talk is really kind of march through and touch on various aspects of these separate systems and try to give you a sort of a better intuitive sense of how flies how flies actually fly. So before doing so, I just want to mention some of the folks who've worked in the laboratory through the years. Some of them are looking for jobs, so I'll want to mention, including graduate students, Michael Tu, Amr Fayazuddin, and Sanjay Sane. I'm going to talk a lot about the work of Lance Tamaro, who's just finishing up his degree at UC Berkeley, and Alana Sherman, postdocs Weipeng Chang, Fritz Olaf Lehmann. I'll talk a lot about the work of Stephen Fry, who's just recently left the lab for a job in Switzerland, and technicians who have literally digitized several hundred million video frames. So I'd like to start with behavior, because I think that's really an important point upon which to focus. And the animals which I'll be describing today are the fruit fly, Drosophila melanogaster. And they do not perform the elaborate mating chases that I showed you for house flies. However, they do exhibit some interesting flight behaviors, and I'm going to focus on one particular form of behavior that really serves as the theme for the talk. And the way that we visualize the flight trajectory of flies is we have sort of stereo video systems that can track the trajectories of flies flying in free flight, and there's several generations of this device. It's not important that you really understand how it works. But the idea is we can track the motion of a fly as it flies around, and we can allow it to fly around in different sensory environments and see what the influence of these different sensory environments have on the behavior of the fly. And so I'm just going to play you a short animation. Now, this is not a simulation. This is just a playback of an actual flight trajectory in a meter diameter arena. And can everybody see the little red dot going around? Now, what you can see is that the flight trajectory is divided into these straight flight sequences interspersed with these rapid turns. These rapid turns are called saccades. They're called saccades by Collett and Land, a direct analogy to the saccadic eye movements that our eyeballs make. So you may not be aware of the fact that you're blind approximately 1 hour a day, because when your eyeballs are rapidly moving, they're moving so fast that your image is blurred. Your brain kind of fixes this so you don't notice. The eye of the fly is attached to the body, so when the body changes, when the flight path changes, the image of that the fly sees is rapidly rotating. That's why they were called saccades. That's not really important as much as you can sort of get an image that looks as almost as if the fly is bouncing off the sides of the arena. It reminds me, and anybody who's old enough, of the old video game Pong, which, you know, I thought was the greatest thing since canned beer when it came out. But the animal is not actually physically bouncing off the walls of the arena. It turns out that they're visually bouncing off the walls of the arena. And this is just the data portrayed slightly, maybe easier, in a way that's easier to see. There's a flight trajectory of the fly, rapid turn, straight flight, rapid turn, straight flight, and so forth. And so it's very easy to characterize these sort of flights into these two categories. And it's a very interesting question of how the flies actually fly straight. Flying straight is not easy, especially when you have to deal with sort of, you know, developmental biological noise. And performing these saccades is not easy. But this talk is going to focus on the saccades. How are they generated? What elicits them? And so forth. So let me give you a little bit better view of the saccades. And I'll get back to this data, these data, later in the talk. So I'm not going to tell you how we gathered this information, but just take it for granted that we did. So what you're going to look at is three high-speed video sequences shot from three different perspectives at 5,000 frames per second of a saccading fly. And if you focus over here, you can see that the fly changes heading in about 8 wing beats and then will accelerate forward out of the field of view of the camera. I'll leave it as a mystery how we convinced a fly to perform a saccade in a 7 millimeter by 7 millimeter by 7 millimeter volume of space. But I hope that gives you some sense of the behavior. So immediately it's apparent that vision has an important influence on when these saccades are generated. If one simply allows the flies to fly in an arena that has a uniform white wall, this is sort of the sensory deprivation experiment, the animals perform saccades relatively close to the wall. Now, there were visual cues. There's a horizon at the bottom of the wall and the top of the wall. But if you give the animal a much richer visual environment by surrounding the wall with the animals with stripes or checkerboards or whatever, you can see that the saccades occur at a much greater distance from the wall of the arena. And that actually changes greatly the distribution of the flight path over time. So in a sense, the visual richness sort of squeezes the fly towards the middle of the arena. So we sort of like to think that the flight behavior is sort of a resonant property of the fly's own sensory motor system with the sensory environment in which the animal is actually flying. And clearly visual information is an important part of that sensory environment. This is a little bit more complicated analysis of such data. And it really answers asked the question of how sophisticated is the computation that goes into these saccades. I'm not going to bore you with the data that shows that saccades are very stereotyped. The pattern of body motion and wing motion is remarkably consistent from saccade to saccade. But one would wonder, can the animal compute how much of a turn it needs to make? So for example, if the animal was heading directly towards the wall, as I am, you'd think that perhaps the most clever thing to do would make a very sharp turn, a complete 180, that would decrease the probability of crashing into the wall. Whereas if it was walking towards the wall at a sort of scant angle, then just a small correction would keep it from crashing. Does the nervous system of the fly perform such a computation? So the way that we tested this, and this is work of Lance Tamaro in the laboratory, one can define a collision angle for one of these straight flight trajectories, which would be the angle that the fly would, at which the fly would hit the wall if it continued on a straight line relative to a normal to the surface of the arena. And this, by the way, gives a good proxy for the sort of asymmetry in optic flow, because if the collision angle is greater than zero, as defined here, that would mean the animal is closer to this wall. The optic flow that's going to occur on this side is much greater than on this side, whereas if the collision angle is less than zero, there's going to be much greater optic flow on the right side of the animal. If the collision angle is zero, which means the fly is heading directly through the center of the arena, then the optic flow on both sides will be matched. So collision angle is a pretty good proxy for sort of the asymmetry of the sensory information which is available to the fly. If you plot the saccade angle as a function of the collision angle prior to the saccade, you see that the points fall into a sort of a bimodal distribution, two clumps that are centered either at 90 degrees to the left or 90 degrees to the right. So if the animal is heading directly towards the wall, it isn't that the animal performs a 180. It either turns to the left or turns to the right with equal probability. So the computation appears to be relatively simple. The animal's not computing how large a turn to make. It's rather that there's the probability of turning either to the right or to the left changes as a function of collision angle. So it's some sense of a bang-bang controller that has sort of two output states. So that's interesting and presumably relates to the complexity of the neural architecture that's controlling the saccades. Now, so that really is all I'm going to say about the behavior, but I think it gives you an idea, a flavor for the phenomenology that we're trying to describe. So let me now talk about the visual feedback that we believe triggers the generation of these saccades and can lead to at least a calculation of turning to one direction or another. So a lot is known about the visual system of flies, particularly Drosophila, from work primarily in Germany over the last half century. So if you imagine taking a fly and taking a section through the head of the fly, and then look at the brain within the head capsule. Most of the tissue that you would be looking at is actually tissue dedicated to visual processing. And there are three optic ganglia that are important to recognize: the retina, which contains the primary photoreceptors, the lamina, which contains their second order cells, the medulla, third order cells, and then finally an additional optic ganglion, which is very important, called the lobular plate. Now, without getting into the complexities of neuroanatomy, the important point is that information from the retina to the lamina to the medulla is processed in a columnar manner, such that light levels encoded by a photoreceptor in the retina, that photoreceptor projects to a cell in the lamina, which projects to a cell in the medulla. So spatial representation of the external world is maintained through those three stages. However, in the lobula, you see an enormous amount of convergence. So within the lobular plate, there are approximately 60 cells, so-called lobular plate tangential cells, or tangential giants, that receive convergent input across visual space. And these cells have been greatly studied because they're easy to stick electrodes into, and they have interesting properties. So they have unique morphologies and identifiable physiologies. And the interesting thing about these cells is that the local input cells that contact the lobular plate tangential cells are directionally sensitive to local visual motion. That computation takes place somewhere within the lamina or the medulla, and there's a lot of research actively, but you can think of these things as being little tiny local motion detectors. And the lobular plate tangential cells integrate motion across visual space such that they're sensitive to large field motion. And I just want to talk a little bit about these the motion detection algorithm itself, because it's really one of the classic examples, one of the early examples of biophysics, studied by a physicist, Reichert, in the early 50s, who proposed with his student Hoschenstein the so-called delay and correlate model for motion detection, based on research in flies. And the way that this is envisioned to work is that you can imagine that these are two visual channels, adjacent visual channels, adjacent, say, photoreceptors within the retina. And you imagine that this is a little tiny, you know, white spot or contrast boundary moving across the retina. It would excite one input channel. And this is the architecture that Hoschenstein and Reichert proposed, which has been to some extent verified by physiology. There'd be a divergence from the detector to an adjacent pathway and via a time delay to an underlying sort of pathway, such that as the contrast boundary continues to move and there's a reciprocal arrangement, that if the velocity of this motion was on the same sort of had the same time constant as this delay, then a correlator here would register as high, whereas a correlator here wouldn't. And then by sort of summing the output of adjacent correlators, one would have a directionally sensitive motion detector. So it's just an interesting, if anybody's interested in this, I can point them to a vast, and I mean vast, literature on this interesting circuit. But the reason I mention it is that it's because of all the research in this field, and that's very quantitative, it's quite easy to generate a mathematical representation of how the fly's visual system would perceive motion through space. So we can simulate the output of these local motion detectors, and we can take the trajectory of a fly and reconstruct at each point in time how its visual system, how its array of motion detectors would be perceiving its motion through space. And the basic strategy here is to do an inverse correlation. We can sort of say, every time the fly turned to the left, what was it looking at? What was its visual system seeing? Every time it turned to the right, what was its visual system seeing? We can gain some insight into the sensory cues that the nervous system is using to trigger the saccades. So let me give you a sense of that. Here's a little video of an animation of a fly moving through the arena. So it's going across the arena. The far side of the arena is looming, and the little red arrows are the output of these mathematically simulated local movement detectors. Let me just play that again so you get a sense. And these rapid rotations, by the way, are the saccades.
So in some sense, this is what his brain sees.
Yeah, in a sort of a abstract way.
So within a lot of the arrows, red arrows,
yeah.
Big, that means you just about to hit that.
Well, no, so the red arrows are the magnitude of local motion, and their orientation is the direction of local motion. And the fly's visual system is believed to have sort of a superposition of orthogonal motion detectors such that they can, you know, can construct the direction of motion in a sort of two-dimensional plane mapped onto the sphere of the world.
This is like the stereo vision. The arrows are bigger, means you're closer, right?
Well, okay, that's actually an interesting question that relates to a whole other topic, and that's how flies perceive depth, which is a very interesting topic. There's almost no bilateral overlap in the visual system. There is some in Drosophila, but it's not much. And there's many experiments that show that, in fact, the way that flies are perceiving depth is by comparing comparing a velocity of the objects, or motion sensitivity. Basically, nearby objects should be moving faster than far away objects. It's a great question, but fortunately, I'm going to have to skip on that one. The net result of this analysis is sort of the following model, that it appears from doing that reverse correlation analysis that its expansion. It's an expanding flow field that actually triggers the saccades, such that if the animal's flying around and the image on the left side expands and it looks as if there's sort of an integrator, it passes a threshold, that triggers a saccade to the right and inhibits the saccade to the left. Whereas if the animal's flying such that there's expansion on the right, that passes a critical threshold, the animal saccades to the left, and you get an inhibition of the saccade to the right. You never see an animal trying to saccade in both directions, which would, you know, be somewhat disastrous. And this is actually a general feature of collision avoidance's escape systems, that, you know, you usually have some sort of anatomical means of mutual inhibition so that you know, when push comes to shove, you always make one choice or the other. Now,
so you said that the left eye and the right eye, there's almost no overlap. So what you're showing us is what they see in through one eye only, right?
Well, we sort of, yeah. It's a, in that particular movie, things are simplified so that it's as if the fly had a perfect sort of panoramic vision of 360 degrees, and we're not worrying about the complexities of the overlap for that particular exercise. It's really just for demonstration purposes. Now, there's got to be more to the story, because flies don't just fly around, you know, avoiding things. They occasionally land, and that is indicated by a sort of simulation or animation of another experiment, which the fly was flying around an arena, but we put vertical objects within the arena. I've color-coded them here for our convenience. The flies don't have color vision that would allow them to, well, the objects were black in any event. But you can see that the flies perform this behavior that's called fixation. They'll sort of head towards one post, and then as the post looms, they saccade away from it. However, they don't, you know, occasionally, eventually, they land on things, as in this case. So we know in order for the fly to, you know, complete its mission, in a sense, which in the case of a fruit fly is probably either, you know, searching for a food resource or flying away from a food resource and looking for a suitable perch during the warm time of day. So there have to be visual cues that don't make the animal continue to fly and saccade away, but actually land. And so in order to study this in a little bit more detail, we use a technique that we've been using for years now in the laboratory that allows us to more precisely control what a fly sees and feels. And that's a sort of virtual reality situation where we tether the fly to one spot, which is just a fancy way of saying we glue it to a stick. And we use various sensors to measure what the fly is trying to do, either by tracking optically on a wing beat by wing beat basis the speed and amplitude of its wing strokes on the left and right side, or by measuring the aerodynamic torque the fly is producing. It doesn't really make a difference. But the important thing is that what the fly does, say the difference in stroke amplitude, is fed back into some feature of the visual world, such as the angular velocity of a pattern. So the fly can sit there and play a little video game, and then we can manipulate the video game to test particular hypotheses. So you can imagine that sort of as the animal changes its stroke amplitude and wiggles its abdomen or whatever, it can move the stripe around. Let me show you some examples of these experiments. So the animal is controlling the angular velocity of the visual pattern in front of it, which is sort of purposely shot out of focus to give you a better representation of how a fly would see the world. They basically are imaging the world with a 23 by 23 pixel camera, which is very low resolution. And the fly's done its job, so we give it its world back. In this particular case. Now, there's lots of experiments that one can do. This is the tethered flight arena manifestation of that fixation behavior. If you give them a vertical stripe, they'll just steer towards that vertical stripe till the cows come home, or actually till they run out of energy. In fact, they'll steer towards any sort of cohesive, vertically aligned object, which means that every 4 years we always do elections to see, which could have been critical, say, in tipping the float in Florida 2 years ago. Unfortunately, a pattern emerges that the flies always tend to choose the candidate with more letters in their name. Although in this case, people have pointed out that it was kind of unfair because they went for Nader, but the background was green, and the flies had to tilt to the left in order to read the letters.
One more visual complexity, is that why they're more?
It's probably just a stronger stimulus. But you can actually do experiments with this arrangement, and here's one that relates to the problem of how a fly decides whether to turn or to saccade. So this is what we call the fly swatter experiment. We allow the fly to orient towards a little black square, and then randomly we expand the square and measure what the fly's behavior is in response to the expansion. And so here's a little icon for the experiment, and the results are rather interesting. If the square expands on the animal's left, that causes an increase in left amplitude of the wing, a decrease in the right amplitude. That would result, as I'll show you later, in an aerodynamic force that would turn the animal away from the expansion. So that seems to confirm the free flight experiments, that the animal turns away from expanding stimulus. If the stimulus expands on the animal's right, you get an increase in right stroke amplitude, decrease in left. Again, the animal turns away from the stimulus. If the stimulus expands directly in front of the animal, you don't get an asymmetrical wing response, but you get this strange thing here that I'm calling a leg response, which was measured with another sensor we'll talk about. Now, the leg response is this very characteristic stereotype behavior depicted here with PowerPoint weaselry. It's a rapid extension of the legs. It's been studied for years. It really does look like that. I mean, it's basically putting out the landing gear.
It's not going to actually slow down. Just zooms in and...
actually, what isn't plotted here, but we have the data, I just have included. What also characterizes the landing response is the increase in wing beat frequency. And the increase in wing beat frequency, generally, with some subtle changes in the wing stroke, causes a pitching up. So the animal sort of sticks its legs out and pitches up a bit. But you can sort of see here that it's a very robust system, so it really doesn't matter whether the animal contacts the ground here, here, or here, it's able to sort of recover. And that's definitely part of the strategy that it's utilizing. But with respect to this question of sort of decision making, what's interesting is that so you can see that the probability of these behaviors depends upon where the focus of the expanding stimulus. So if the stimulus expands, say, to the animal's left or to the animal's right, then you get a very robust wing response that turns the animal either, or turns it in both, in all cases, takes the animal away from the expanding stimulus. However, if the stimulus expands towards the center of the animal's field of view, you have a higher probability of this landing response. And there's some overlap. So for example, at an intermediate, say at 45 degrees to the left, there's, you know, a 50% probability you'll get a landing response, and you also get a collision avoidance. So this tells us that these two behavioral pathways are in parallel, and they're not exclusive of one another, which again ultimately must relate to the neural architecture controlling the behavior. So we have to modify.
Now flies evolve in a world without fly swatters. So this is a predator that would suddenly approach, or.
Well, that's one way to think of it. I think what's more likely ecological evolutionary interpretation of this is the fact that the flight velocity of a fly is very small relative to the velocity of winds that it's likely to encounter. So if you're a little fly hovering and a gust comes up, you know, you're going to be very easily carried towards a tree. And so that's really the way that I interpret why this very, very robust lateral expansion response.
So you don't want to hit the tree.
Right? You don't want to hit the tree. Well, I actually that's an interesting point. Maybe you can ask me about later, but I think that a lot of this may relate to maybe used for an upwind odor response. Because if you measure the drag on a fly, any deviation from the direction of the wind would actually cause side slip. So by turning away from lateral expansion, that algorithm played out in even a gentle wind would always result in the animal flying upwind. And searching behaviors in insects is closely tied with upwind flight because it makes sense. If you smell something, the best strategy to do is fly upwind, right?
The search for food is completely driven by odor, right? By smell, not by vision. I mean, the
long distance drive, yeah, because the visual cues are.
I see, but yeah. Short distance, once you get within the food, then it's by the visual system.
Possibly, I mean, there's much better work on that in other insects that have greater visual acuity. I mean, my guess is a fly can't really tell the difference between, you know, an apple and a banana, and it's probably not a choice flies ever evolved to have to make. So the idea is here is that we have sort of three pathways for saccading to the left, saccading to the right, and landing that have to have neural circuits capable of measuring expansion in at least, you know, front, left, and right. Okay, so that's kind of concludes the part of the visual system of how visual processing is important, figuring out how these saccades are triggered. Now I want to sort of shift gears to talk about how they're actually generated by the fly mechanically. So to consider the musculoskeletal mechanics that are ultimately causing the changes in wing motion that allow the fly to turn. And the flight mechanics of flies are rather interesting. Like a lot of the most successful groups of insects, including ants, bees, wasps, beetles, but actually evolved at least 8 times independently in the evolution of insects, is this interesting system in which the flight muscles are divided into 2 physiologically, morphologically, anatomically distinct groups, large power muscles that generate the mechanical power required to flap the wings, produce aerodynamic forces, and fly. And these muscles are not attached to the wing. They actually impart strains upon the exoskeleton that transmit strains to the base of the wing by a complex mechanical linkage. They're asynchronous in the sense that they're not told to contract on a wing-beat-by-wing-beat basis by the nervous system. They're actually stretch-activated, and they comprise a mechanical resonator, such that if the dorsal longitudinal downstroke muscles are active, it basically sort of pops the top of the thorax upwards and stretches these muscles, the upstroke muscles, and it's the act of stretch, not the arrival of an impulse from the nervous system, that causes these muscles to contract. And they have a molecular specialization that allows them to behave in this way. When they contract, they pull the top of the thorax down, which drives the wings up, but stretches these muscles, which activates them, and so what you end up with is this kind of this mechanical resonance that can go, you know, in some insects up to 1,000 wing beats per second, much faster than a muscle can contract under neural control, and that's presumably why it evolved. However, these muscles are as big and strong as they are, they're dumb. They're not being controlled by the nervous system. They're not capable of rapid changes in physiology and mechanical properties. And as a consequence, the role of steering is done by a set of little tiny muscles that actually are connected, directly connected to the wing hinge, and basically act as a transmission system to alter the way in which strains generated by the cuticle are transmitted into kinematic alterations of the wing. For example, this is one muscle I'll talk a little bit about that is sort of attached to a nail-like structure on the inside of the animal. And as the wing goes back up and down, this muscle is sort of stretched back and forth. But then as the nervous system activates this muscle, it can actively alter the mechanics of the wing hinge, thereby changing the way in which the wing beats during flight. Let me give you a little sense of that. This is a a movie from a large fly, although similar experiments have been done on small flies. So I have to be quiet. Can everybody hear the clicks? The clicks are coming from electrodes implanted in one muscle on this side of the animal. And just listen for the clicks and watch the wing motion. So those same electrodes can be used as stimulating electrodes. So it's possible to sort of verify the utility of this muscle by actively stimulating it and seeing what effect it has on wing motion. So I reiterate that this would represent in the animal's nervous system the output of a single neuron. So a single neuron can have quite profound effects on the kinematics and subsequently behavior during flight. So it's important, I think, I want to take a little bit of time to delve into the complexities of this neural control, because I think it actually raises some issues in information processing that may be general within biological systems, some certain kinds of biological systems. So what I just described to you can be described as a frequency control or a sort of rate code, in the sense that when the muscle was quiescent in this large fly, you saw that the wing beat through a very narrow stroke envelope, because it basically the muscle wasn't particularly stiff. As the frequency driving the muscle increases the stiffness of the muscle, that somehow caused a tonic change in the mechanics of the wing hinge, which caused a reconfiguration that made the wing beat over a larger stroke amplitude, larger velocity, and so forth. And that's certainly one way in which these muscles work. But there's a lot more subtle and interesting things going on. So this is a recording from such an experiment showing a series of action potentials. These are the little electrical impulses in the motor neurons that control the muscles. And it's just showing, if you looked at this, you'd say, well, you know, there's a muscle that's just firing tonically. But a much more interesting picture emerges if you actually map the timing of those impulses onto the up and down motion or back and forth motion of the wing, which could only be done, this was done by Michael Tu in my laboratory, by doing electrophysiology in conjunction with high-speed video. So at 3,000 frames per second, we could capture the images, which are just mapped onto, or shown here as the back and forth motion of the wing. And the blue dots are just the occurrences of the spikes mapped onto the wing motion. You can see that most of the time, the spikes occur, these electrical impulses, at the upstroke to downstroke transition. So when the wing is sort of right here, and under those conditions, the wing follows this sort of trajectory. However, occasionally, the muscle fires a little bit earlier at the end of the upstroke. And when it does, the wing actually it follows a more anterior trajectory during the downstroke and a larger stroke amplitude. And sometimes the wing rather the muscle fires much earlier in the downstroke. And under those conditions, and these are just little tiny sub-millisecond shifts in timing, the wing follows a much larger anterior deviation. And I'll show you aerodynamically later that has very important consequences and a larger stroke amplitude. So there's a in addition to this frequency control, there's actually a phase control. And Michael Tu did a lot of work. You know, it's always the horror when someone's dissertation is condensed to a single slide. He did a lot of very difficult biophysical experiments on the muscle itself in the fly to show that these phase advances and phase delays change the dynamic stiffness of the muscle. So basically, the nervous system is using this muscle as a controllable spring. The muscle cannot generate positive mechanical work. It actually absorbs energy. How much it absorbs, however, depends upon the phase at which it is activated within each wing beat cycle. So that's one of the ways that the brain is conveying information to this flight control system, is by sort of shifting the phase of activation to these little muscles. And it raises an important neuroethological question: what is controlling the phase of activation? Where does the timing input come come to the motor neurons, to the little cells controlling this muscle? So it is not an internal clock. There's no internal timer that tells the muscle when to fire. All the input turns out to come from peripheral sensory cells that are active on a wing beat by wing beat basis. So it's basically little tiny reflexes. And one important source of those reflexes are little sensors in the armpit of the fly. These sensors are called campaniform scintilla. And basically, and this is electrophysiology done by Amr Fayazid in my lab years ago, they make what's called a monosynaptic reflex arc. So the cells from these sensors go directly to the motor neurons, such as the B1. And when basically the wings go up, they make the motor neuron fire. When the wings go up, they make the motor neurons fire. So if you activate this wing input, you generate, you know, at fixed latency, a single action potential. So this would be a very, very good reflex for making sure that the motor neuron fires at exactly the same time in each wing beat cycle. However, because it's phase locked to the wing beat cycle, by its very nature, it can't be time shifted relative to the wing beat cycle. So there has to be some other inputs of information. And it turns out that one of the important sources of additional phasic information is a structure called the halter. The halter is a modified hindwing of the fly, shown here in a rather old and fuzzy high-speed video. But that little white dot beating back and forth in antiphase with the wing is a modified hindwing that's lost all of its aerodynamic function but still beats. It has a bunch of sensory arrays, and this structure is used as it's usually described as a gyroscope that measures the angular rotations of the animal during flight. More properly, it's a Coriolis force detector that detects the cross product of the translational velocity of the halter as it beats back and forth with the the angular velocity vector of the fly. And it's a complicated story. There are sensors that sort of enable it to detect and discriminate yaw pitch and roll because of its orientation with respect to the axis and because of the directional sensitivity of the sensors at the base of the halter. And it's a wonderful story, but it's definitely unequivocal that this thing, that there are sensors on the halter that are sensitive to, that can differentiate Coriolis forces from all the other forces acting on the halter, such as gravity, acceleration, and so forth.
The halter is this little wing.
The halter is this little wing. So the way that we've been studying halter function is to take one of our flight arenas and to put it in sort of an electronic cocktail shaker. So here's a fly happily flying away, glued to a stick, and it's controlling that visual panorama in front of it. And then we can oscillate the entire fly mechanically in either the sort of yaw, pitch, or roll directions. Now, I guarantee you that no flies were harmed in the filming of this sequence. The flies actually like to do this. My graduate student, Alana Sherman, who was an engineer, and she was so horrified to actually work with real animals. And then when she did these experiments, she felt so sorry for the fly. She like carefully pried them off the stick at the end and let them go. And but then the flies come back and they line up to like get on again. So we're sure that they like this. So the reflexes that these halters mediate are quite phenomenal in their robustness. So if you pitch the animal back and forth and you monitor the changes in the amplitude of the left and right wing, you can see that pitches cause sort of synergistic, concerted modulations of left and right stroke amplitude, and also the frequency at which the wings are beating. Whereas changes in role cause a sort of a contralateral asymmetric modulation so that when the animal rolls to the left, for example, the left wing beat increases and the right wing beat decreases. And the way that the whole system works is sort of schematized cartoon form here. The animal's flying stably. If it's pitched forward, that the halteres detect that, and that causes an increase in the stroke amplitude of both wings, which makes a restorative moment to bring the animal back. If it's pitched backwards, the stroke amplitudes decrease, and so forth. And a similar reflex stabilizes the animal. around the roll axis. So how is it that the halter is designed to be able to enact these changes in wing motion via this phase coding that I was describing earlier? Well, it turns out that the halter is normally silent because in stable flight, the sensors that contact these motor neurons are not active. However, when the halter becomes active, it actually makes a very strong electrical synapse, which means that there's a direct cytoplasmic bridge between the sensory cells on the halter and the sensory cells on the wing. That makes the input very strong, so that under conditions when wing input is being given to the motor neuron and the halter input, the halter input wins. The halter input is stronger, and so in a sense, this muscle shifts from wing time to halter time. And this is able to generate these phase advances and phase decreases, which can modulate the biomechanical properties of the muscle and thus the kinematic motion of the wing.
Now, there's nothing more to the flight than just the robot. There's no thinking in anybody's heart.
Okay, that's a different conversation. I mean, we tend to call these things in the laboratory, you know, these stinking little robots. And we don't say stinking, we say something else. But the way I think about it is that's sort of the null hypothesis. You know, the null hypothesis is that they're just clever little robots. But that leaves the possibility that there's something that they do, decisions that they make that you really would want to, you'd have to describe in this, using terms like cognition and so forth. But I certainly think in terms of flight behavior, you know, they're clever little robots.
For example, one question is whether the male flies and female flies, are they different? Because you show this tracking behavior.
Well, in house flies, they are. There's actually different parts of the visual system that are specialized in males for tracking females and other male interlopers.
So females just don't track males, right? So
it really depends on which species, but in most cases, that's correct. So one question is, if you have this very strong reflexive system, how does the fly do anything? Kind of relates to your question. And that's a problem of any sort of over-tuned control system. I mean, how do you override it? And one interesting thing is that not only does the wing have power muscles and steering muscles, so does the halter. The halter has its own set of control muscles that can modulate how it beats and its sensitivity. These are really tiny things. They're basically tendons with an attitude. And this is, you know, the sort of the wonders of evolution, that the halter evolved from the wing. It's a serial repetition of the wing. Not only does it have, you know, the wing hinge and the ability of motion, it also inherited all of the control muscles. And what interesting factor that we've found is that these control muscles of the halter receive visual input. So in other words, if you present a moving patterns in front of the fly, you alter the firing patterns of control muscles, not of the wing. We actually haven't found that pathway yet. But you modify the patterns of the halter muscles, the control muscles of the halter. So that raises the possibility that you have a pathway of information. Well, we know we do have a pathway of information from the visual system to the halter control muscles, and then from the sensors of the halter to the wing muscles itself. So it raises the possibility that this pathway could be used either for just sort of gain control, in which one sensory modality adjusts the gain of another sensory modality, or actually a means by which the visual system can kind of override the halter input or perform sort of virtual flight perturbations that then make the animal do a involuntary flight maneuver. So it's sort of like fooling your autopilot in order to perform a voluntary maneuver. We don't know the final story on this, but I just want to show you an image sort of for the evolutionary minded in the audience. Flies are serially are arthropods. They have a serial organization of the body, segment organization of the body, and we find an odd sort of repetition of circuitry such that in the prothoracic ganglion, which there are no wings, but there are neck motor neurons that control the head, and those neck motor neurons, those neck muscles have motor neurons, they have sensors associated with them. Those sensors control neck muscles, wing muscles, and halter muscles. Wing sensors control neck muscles, wing muscles, and halter muscles, and halter sensors control halter muscles, wing muscles, and neck muscles. So you have a complete set of reciprocal interactions. And so this is where it gets, this is sort of the guts of this clever little robot, that you have all these sort of reflexes that are superimposed, and every sensory modality can control the gain of every other sensory modality, and the neural architecture is just sort of repeated. This is a famous picture from Ed Lewis, who won the Nobel Prize for his description of the bithorax complex and the discovery of sort of homeotic genes, the basis of homeotic mutations in Drosophila. And in this particular mutation, the halter is transformed back into a wing, and that in a kind of cheesy way, but informative way, may phenocopy the ancestry of insects, where you originally had a serial array of appendages. So this is a reconstruction from the work of Jarmila Kukulova-Peck. But the one idea here is that in insects, sort of a primitive means of phase in training all the appendages is to have sensory cells on one appendage control the wing muscles on another appendage and so forth. In a sense, the halter system, as derived as it is, really actually still fits this basic framework.
Is that related to the centipede with all these cells?
Well, yeah. I mean, so in a sense, yes. So centipedes are believed to be serially repeated, have a more obvious segmented pattern than do insects. But people have for years tried to sort of reconstruct the ancestry of insects. So I realize I only have, over time, let me very quickly just get to the last part of the talk, which relates to the aerodynamics, because in order to really understand how these changes in wing motion, really what these changes in wing motion mean to the behavior, we have to understand the aerodynamics. And this is where we spent a lot of energy and time in the lab, and everybody sort of heard this myth about how engineers proved that bumblebees couldn't fly and all this silliness. The theory that's worked for Orville and Wilbur, and aerodynamicists have been using for about 100 years, works really well. It doesn't work particularly well for flapping insects, and the basis of this idea that you can prove a bumblebee can't fly comes from the sense that the exercise that if you get the kinematics of a flapping wing and you freeze the wing in different individual positions throughout the stroke and you treat it as an airfoil operating under steady state conditions, and then you try to calculate the forces based on that assumption, you end up with a force that's too low to explain the animal's flight. So for example, you can take the insect wing, you can stick it in a wind tunnel, you can measure lift and drag as a function of angle of attack, you can plug in those lift and drag values into different values of angle of attack and wing velocity throughout the stroke, you can sum it all up, and what you end up with is that the average lift is less than the body weight. So that's basically the problem. And so to gain insight into this problem, what my lab and other labs around the world have done, because the solutions for the Navier-Stokes equation for flapping wings are really not reliable enough yet, is to generate giant dynamically scaled insects. So this is Robofly. Well, actually, this is Borf, which is Bride of Robofly. They haven't mated yet. We don't know why, Borf sits in 3 metric tons of mineral oil. It has a wingspan of about 0.5 meter, and it flaps at approximately 200 millihertz. And it's all dynamically scaled, so it operates at the same Reynolds number. Just very briefly, experiments with Robofly have told us that there's sort of 3 main components of the forces, of the time history of forces. So these are actually measured forces when you plug in sort of insect kinematics to RoboFly. The most important mechanism is called delayed stall. The wings operate at a very high angle of attack. Flow separates off the leading edge, causing a leading edge bubble that stays attached to the wing so that you have basically this low pressure system, if you will, generating a large upward pressure force for the duration of the stroke. In addition, because insect wings flap back and forth, they actually rotate over 90 degrees at the end of each half stroke. And as they're rotating, that rotation serves as an additional source of circulation, increasing the size of the leading edge vortex, increasing the pressure force. And then at stroke reversal, the wing comes to a complete stop, starts moving the opposite direction. But unlike an airplane that moves constantly away from its own wake, insects actually are passing, the wing passes back and forth through the wake of the previous stroke. It can actually extract energy out of that wake, and that's a mechanism we call wake capture. And these can be seen by an animation of digital particle image velocimetry that shows the pattern of flow and color-coded vorticity. So as the wing rotates, you can see that force vector getting larger. And then as it changes direction, you can see a large increase in that force vector as the wing passes through the vorticity field shed from the previous stroke.
Similar to what fish do?
There are some analogies, but because fish are a little, it depends on the fish, and fish are very diverse. It's a complicated question. But some fish seem to show similar mechanisms. But now to get to the point, that's all background. How do we understand how the flies are generating saccades? Well, this is where we took little objects, we lace them with vinegar. That entices the fly to fly towards them. As the object looms and you put enough flies in the box, which is, you know, I guess the the honest thing to say, some of them will perform a perfect saccade right in a little tiny visual volume. And then what we can do is we can digitize the body motion and the wing motion, and we can take these patterns of motion, we can figure out what the wing kinematics were, we can play the wing kinematics through RoboFly, and then reinsert the pattern of forces on the original kinematics. So you start with a sequence like this. This is another one of these saccades. You'll see the animal come in, changes flight path. It was a very sharp saccade. You can also see how rigid the body is during these patterns. Okay, so then fast forward half a year, you know, or a year, and you know the sanity of several postdocs and technicians in the laboratory. And then you can sort of see the time history of aerodynamic forces throughout the saccade. So, okay, lots of data, but it's not really important. This is just this is one saccade sequence. You can see the animal changing its orientation. It's indicated by an alteration on the yaw axis. The take-home message is the alteration of kinematics, shown here as the sort of the three orthogonal angles that can describe the wing motion. It's extraordinarily subtle, and this troubled us. However, the influence that it has on forces, plotted here in a sort of the external frame of reference, you can see that there is an alteration in forces as the saccade proceeds. And the take-home message is as follows. Right here, color-coded from red to black, is the amount of torque produced by one wing within a given stroke. And what happens as the animal tries to generate torque to produce a saccade is that there's a backwards tilt of the stroke plane and an increase in amplitude on the outside wing of a saccade. So in other words, the red wing sequences, and this is a summary of all the data set, the red wing sequences are generating higher torque. So you can see this backwards tilt and this increase in amplitude. And aerodynamically what's happening is that here's a wing moving back and forth. As you tilt it backwards, that increases the aerodynamic angle of attack during the upstroke. And the increase in stroke amplitude, keeping wing beat frequency constant, increases the velocity. Those two effects cause an increase in force. So by sort of tilting the wing back and forth, you can get a modulation, of the force acting primarily during the upstroke. And so by modulating having a higher upstroke force on the outside wing during the turn, that generates the torque that turns the animal through the saccade. Now, the question is, are these effects enough to really explain the dynamics of the saccade? So here's the animal's acceleration and angular velocity. I'm just talking about the yaw axis because that's really the important axis. Acceleration and velocity during the turn. We can approximate this as sort of a simple mass damp system where you have a moment of inertia and some sort of frictional damping term and the angular velocity and angle of acceleration. So we can use that equation. We can calculate from first principles the moment of inertia and frictional damping for the morphology of the fly, and then we can just use the simple mass damp equation to calculate the torque that would be required to turn the fly through that kinematic pattern, and then we can compare that to measured force. There's a remarkably close fit. And the thing that this says about the dynamics of the fly, counter to all the literature, is that these small flies had always been modeled as a an overdamped system, where the moment of inertial term, the inertial term is irrelevant. It's exactly the opposite. The flies are actually an inertial system, which is why they actually have to produce counter torque to end the turn. And so it gives a totally different view of the dynamic. And this is a very tiny little insect. So that insects in general are much more inertial than anyone would have imagined. Finally, just to give you some, why would there be any practical applications to this stuff? And I just want to show briefly some of the work of Ron Fearing, who I have some collaboration with, who's trying to actually build a micromechanical fly that based on some of these properties. And here's the motion of its wing that's generated to produce both flapping and rotation.
What's the size of this thing?
It has a 2-centimeter wingspan. And this is the half a fly, or demi fly, or half a bee, which is able to sort of produce about 50% of the force that is actually needed. But by modulating the phase of wing motion, just as the actual fly does, it can generate forces in, vertical forces and horizontal forces and so forth. So Ron Fearing's...
This is just the mechanical aspect, not you don't have the feedback.
Well, they're actually starting to build the feedback into it. But the idea was first to kind of get the platform off the ground, so to speak. Yeah, so, but at the moment, what this has is the kinematics and the aerodynamics of a real fly. Mm-hmm. So, anyway, I hope you got some impression of how an integrative approach to a complex problem can shed some insight into, certainly insect flight, but perhaps it's a strategy that can be used for other biological systems as well. And I thank you for your patience and be happy to take any questions.
What is the value of the Reynolds number?
What is the value?
Yeah.
You mean what is the numerical value? What is the numerical value? Okay. I didn't know what you meant by it.
So the Reynolds number is basically circa 100. Other questions? For a fruit fly.
Can we go back to the slide that has the cross section of the fly brain and the interaction between the brain and the visual, the eye and the...
Hey, I did it. That's pretty good.
So how many, you mentioned that there were, how many layers of cells are there in these different layers? And compared to the human eye, are there different kinds of cells that...
Yes.
Positive and negative zones and differential receivers from the...
That's a really interesting question. It looks as if functionally it does a lot of, especially in the peripheral end of the eye, it does a lot of the same computations that the vertebrate retina does. It does them somewhat differently. It does them through different kinds of synapses, for example. So things like lateral inhibition does take place. So there's a whole kind of field that tries to draw analogy between vertebrate vision and insect vision.
one of the hottest questions is whether the motion detection circuit is equivalent. And there's sort of historical differences. So the insect people have generally followed the kind of Hochenstein-Riker model, whereas a lot of the vertebrate vision has tended to follow models that have come out of artificial intelligence that are different kinds of sort of true velocity. But more and more, it's kind of converging. And I think that it looks as if there might be some features about vertebrate motion detection that do look more like the kind of Hochenstein delay and correlate model.
How many layers of cells are there exactly in the lamina and the medulla?
Oh, well, okay, but okay. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to evade the question. So, you know, there's a cell here that contacts a cell here, that contacts a cell here, that contacts a cell here. However, that really doesn't give you a good picture because within cells and between cells, there's phenomenal feedback that's taking place. So there's a lot of information that's passing this way, this way, this way, and so forth. Yeah, and there's lots of sort of reciprocal collateral connections.
Question in the back.
So you were talking about this resonator that's making the wings flap.
Yeah.
Are you doing it automatically, like one stretching down, the other stretching down first? How would it stop?
Yeah, okay, so the nervous system does have a role. It has a tonic role. So for example, when the wing beats are, say, going up and down at such and such a frequency, if you record from the motor neurons driving these muscles, they'd be firing something like that at that frequency with no phase relationship. And the role of this is to basically release enough calcium within the muscle, as in all muscles, the cross bridges require calcium for activation. But instead of the calcium causing a sort of a brief momentary activation, they cause a tonic activation that keeps the muscle in a stretch-activated state. Now, the important cell biological issue is that it's not the activation that's really limiting here, it's the deactivation, because a muscle twitch, a typical muscle twitch, looks like this. And the reason for that is calcium is being released from internal stores. That's diffusion driven through an enormous concentration gradient. The deactivation is an active process that's going against the concentration gradient. And the only way to get it, you know, if you want something to go fast, the only way to sort of get a faster deactivation is to have more and more and more surface area. And the problem with a really fast vertebrate muscle is that most of its internal volume is not contractile fibers, it's just the membrane of the storage system to suck up calcium. So fast muscles tend to be really wimpy. And so in insect evolution, you at least 8 times got to the point that you couldn't get any smaller and any faster using these kinds of muscles. And so these asynchronous muscles, which really what they let you do is get rid of that whole calcium storage system, because you know you can have really, really slow deactivation. So how do they stop? The muscles will continue to oscillate for a while, but because you can have control muscles that can disengage the wings can stop flapping.
Okay, a question from Phil Lubin.
If you compare the energetics of an insect with the energetics of a man-made flying machine, how do they compare? Do you have any idea whether an insect is much more efficient?
Well, if you scale it properly, you know, there are these sort of curves that look at kind of cost of, well, I mean, it depends on how you define efficiency, but kind of take any measure of efficiency. If you look at it at you know, at a matter of scale, you know, you tend to find like relationships like this where, you know, these are all man-made objects and these are all insects. So, or birds are in the middle and so forth. So, insects tend to be less efficient, but they're on the same regression as defined by large aircraft and small aircraft. Nobody really knows why this is the case, but you know, there's lots of reason why things get efficient as they get small. It generally all has to do with viscosity one way or the other. What's kind of interesting, though, is that if you try to build a mechanical device the size of an insect, there's this sort of 6-inch wall. You can go to any model shop and buy very cheaply an airplane, you know, with an internal combustion engine and propeller, and it flies. You make it a little bit smaller and it doesn't. And so there's this kind of design wall that if you just make an internal combustion engine, airplane wings, a little bit smaller, they just don't work enough anymore. And that's exactly the range where you start to see insect-type flight with hummingbirds, where instead of like trying to fly like this, they're flying like this. So the idea is that this reciprocal pattern of wing motion is sort of something that occurs to sort of get over this hump, which is why a lot of the people trying to build micro air vehicles in that small size range are not trying to build little tiny airplanes, they're trying to build flapping things. Absolutely. I mean, and that's why, you know, it's one of the reasons why the California condor is in bad shape. I mean,
but they're gliders, right? Mostly.
Well, exactly. They have to glide. And you know, basically, you know, something around the size of you know, kind of an eagle. I mean, it sort of reaches the limit where you can really just be an active flyer. So that's exactly right. So there's really no there's no reason to build a flapping airplane. It would be silly.
Other questions?
Will they be able to build the flies, mechanical flies that you described? Is that going to work soon?
Well, I'm just saying that was a work primarily of Ron Fearing at Berkeley. I mean, I'm kind of pro PI of the grant, but he's really the guy. And he'll say, and I think they really will work. I mean, I think the problem is anybody who does this kind of stuff knows that the looming demon, the shadow, the cloud of the shadow of Vesuvius is batteries. That the one thing about biological systems that they have is that fat and mitochondria are really light, and you know, the energy density is just great. Whereas kind of top of the line batteries are just orders of magnitude off. So that's a real limitation.
One more question. Have you measured where the signal between the left and the right eye are mixed for the first time?
Have I measured that? It's known. It's very early. So, for example, there are some of these lobule plate cells. Okay, some of these lobule plate cells have dendrites, meaning they receive information in both lobular plates. So it's at the level of the fourth optic neuropil. However, as I said, because of all these feedback interactions, you know, there's some evidence that it actually can even occur earlier in the processing.
Okay, well, if there's no further questions, let's thank the speaker again.